Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Now, all week long, we've been bringing you some of our favorite deep dives. And today, for our final episode of the week, we'll be revisiting our deep dive into water. We'll start with how most of my days begin.
5:30 a.m. Okay. Time to make the radio. Oh, the coffee pot is dry. Let me fix that. Phew. Okay, that caffeine was critical. Now, I'm going out here and feed and water these chickens.
Good morning, ladies. Oh, nobody's up? Too dark. Okay, here we go. Come on.
Okay. So I'm Dorian Warren, and this is how my day starts. Okay, baby, I'm coming. Daddy's coming.
All right, Dorian. So I figured that on nearly every day of the week, I use water maybe 5 times in at least 3 different locations in my house or yard, all before like 6:30 in the morning.
Melissa, that sounds about right for me too, because every day of the week, I use water at least 5 times at least 4 different locations in my house, all before 7 a.m.
Okay. And yet, to be honest, Dorian, water is such a reliable, regular fixture of my day-to-day life that it had become, frankly, invisible. I just was never thinking about it until 2 weeks ago when I started my day and discovered this.
Whoa, what is that? Why? What's going on?
Okay, I am not proud of this, but it's not some kind of like great story of injustice. Just apparently, in the absolute onslaught of work and family obligations in the past few months, I failed to pay the water bill. I just forgot. Now, to be clear, it's the only household bill that comes as mail rather than electronically. And truth be told, I haven't touched this ever-growing mail avalanche since about August when school restarted for me and the girls. But the solution for me was pretty easy. I called them up, I paid, and by the end of the day, water was restored. But in just those few hours, I gotta tell you, I was shaken from my drowsy complacency about water access. And that complacency is even more embarrassing than forgetting to pay the water bill. Dorian, apparently water access is a full-on environmental, economic, and social problem, both globally and domestically.
Yes, it is, Melissa. And that's exactly where we begin on today's episode of The Takeaway, because it's time for a deep dive into water.
How do we even begin, Dorian? I mean, water isn't just a big topic. It's huge. So do we start with the chemical formula, H2O?
2 portions, hydrogen, 1 portion, oxygen.
Equals H2O.
I mean, we know that water makes up 71% of the Earth's surface, and something like 60% of adult human bodies are constituted by water. So are we going to even talk about this kind of disorienting new theory in astrophysics, which has entirely rewritten our understanding of the origins of water on Earth? Because now apparently scientists have evidence that water may have been stored in the rocks of the Earth in a pre-stellar age before even the emergence of stars?
Okay, calm down, relax. I don't think we need to dive quite that deep, Melissa, but why don't we start in the same place that got you interested in this issue? And that is the lived experience of water.
I don't have a PhD in water. But I do have a PhD that trained me to really listen.
This is Dr. Sarah Young. She is an
associate professor of anthropology and global health at Northwestern University.
Professor Young has been researching how to measure household level water insecurity and how to understand its consequences. Her interest in water began during a food insecurity study in Kenya. She asked women to use a camera to document what aspects of their lives shaped how they fed their children.
There were all these pictures of water, and pictures of water that are fascinating. And women were talking about having the porridge to make for their kids, but not having water to make it. Women talked about having to choose between either using this disgusting sewage water from a prison and having money to buy food, or buying water and not having any money for food. Women talked about getting beaten up if there wasn't water in the house. That was a legitimate, and I use that term ironically, reason for violence. I listened to these women and I saw there was a real need to measure water insecurity differently.
Dorian, a childhood memory rushed back to me as we were listening to Sarah's story. As a kid growing up in the early 1970s, my favorite candy bar was, and still is, the Nestle 100 Grand.
And what would you do with 100 grand?
I'd eat it.
Uh-oh. Okay. Carry on.
Okay. So I distinctly remember standing in the grocery store checkout line, pestering my mom to buy this candy for me. And when she refused, she explained, "You can't have anything made by Nestle because they're killing children in Africa."
Wait, pause. Your mom said what?
She did. And by the way, she was right. Professor Young told me so.
Your mom is smart. I love political mothers.
In 1974, the London-based advocacy organization, The War on Want, published a booklet titled Baby Killer. Now, it laid out results of an investigation into how the baby formula industry, led by Nestle, was aggressively marketing baby formula to women living in impoverished nations. And the marketing claimed that commercial baby formula was superior to breast milk, and it made women feel insufficient if they chose to rely on breastfeeding. And it offered free samples, both to new mothers and to hospitals. Now, Dorian, there's a lot wrong with all of this, but one big problem had to do with water. Of course, baby formula has to be mixed with water. And many of the women living in these impoverished nations did not have reliable access to clean water. But mixing the formula with tainted water and lacking access to water to boil in sterilized bottles and often lacking access to water even to wash hands before preparation, it had dire consequences for thousands of infants who died of diarrhea and malnutrition as a result.
Melissa, I must admit, I've never heard about this global baby formula marketing campaign before, but this memory adds insight to Professor Young's insistence that we begin with lived experience in the scientific study of water insecurity. This is how Professor Young and her international consortium of colleagues developed a broadly valid measure for understanding those lived experiences of water.
So you can think of it as four domains. And the first domain is physical availability. So is there water out there somewhere to be had? The second domain is access. So if it's out there somewhere, can I get to it? The third domain is use. And there's water that's acceptable for example, watering your crops, but you wouldn't want to brush your teeth with it. The fourth domain is reliable or stable. So if water is there and you can get to it and you get it for all your uses, does that happen one day a month? Does it happen every day?
Now, what Sarah is describing is the household water insecurity experiences, or the HWI scale. Now, she and her Northwestern University colleagues, they partnered with UNESCO and the Gallup organization, and they fielded surveys in 31 countries around the world. And this HWI scale, it's the first time researchers have been able to determine the extent of global water insecurity. And considering water across these domains of availability, access, acceptability for use, and reliability, it allowed something pretty stunning to emerge. At least half the global population, about 4 billion people, experience water insecurity at least a month out of every year. And this insecurity has meaningful effects on the physical and mental health from infancy through adulthood. So Professor Young walked us through how the HWI scale helped researchers get a better understanding of these effects.
Probably the best understood way that water is harmful to young children is if it's contaminated. but it shaped infant feeding in other ways. For example, if moms were really dehydrated, they felt like they weren't producing enough breast milk. If moms had to go wait in line a long way away, they would leave their baby with a neighbor, and therefore, you know, they couldn't breastfeed them. They couldn't prepare the food for the babies that they wanted to if water wasn't around to boil the food to make it soft enough. Water touches the well-being of children, nutritional and otherwise, in a lot of other ways that remain invisible if we're not measuring water in a holistic way.
Talking about measurement and research might not seem like critical policy or advocacy, but it's truly foundational for understanding and addressing social inequities.
The parallels between food and water insecurity are very real. I mean, we used to measure food security based on how many calories are available in a country and dividing that by the number of people in the country and saying, oh, there's enough calories here. That's cuckoo bonkers. I mean, we now know that by measuring food insecurity, we can predict depression, school performance, even suicidal tendencies. And I think we're starting to get to that era of water security measurement where we see that even these softer experiences predict really dramatic outcomes. And that's going to help policymakers to prioritize water, to be the unique and irreplaceable resource that it is.
And then to truly illustrate this point, Professor Young took us even deeper. Because water insecurity is not only a global and professional matter for her. It turns out that water is an issue in her own backyard, literally.
I'm an anthropologist. My husband is a synthetic biologist. And when our kids aren't interrupting us at dinner, we sometimes talk about our work. And I told him water insecurity was a really important issue. And he said, hey, I think I can use this synthetic biology technology to do rapid tests for contaminants. Think of it like a pregnancy test for water. And he and his group have since developed rapid at-home tests for lead. So we use these tests to test our own lead. We had really, really high lead, like scary high lead at our house. We live in a house that's older than 100 years. In fact, Chicago, we're number one. We have the most lead lines in all of the nation.
For those of you who don't know, Dorian, well, he's a native Chicagoan.
That's right, Melissa, born and raised on the south side of Chicago. And my very first job at 16 was as a lifeguard on the beach. A very good union job, by the way. And yes, we have miles and miles of beaches on Lake Michigan in Chicago. And I remember spending a lot of time, usually at the crack of dawn when nobody was there, just walking along the beach and staring, you know, into the great abyss of our Great Lake. And Melissa, I remember thinking how plentiful this lake that really looks like an ocean seemed. I mean, I could have never imagined the words water and scarcity or water and insecurity going together. Like, it just never occurred to me. And then my six-year-old nephew a couple years ago got lead poisoning on the south side. So the moment that Professor Young from Northwestern talked about the lead pipe issue in the city that I grew up in, that my family still resides in, I knew we had to take this water discussion back home to Chi-Town.
My name is Josina Morita. I'm a commissioner at the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago, here representing all of Cook County in Illinois.
Okay, so we know you might not know what our water reclamation district is. So I asked Commissioner Morita.
I always say we're the most important agency that nobody knows exists. The Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago covers all of Cook County's storm and sewer water. So that's over 5 million people. We're the largest in the world.
Now, Melissa, we turned our attention to Chicago because Professor Young told us about finding elevated lead levels in her family's drinking water. So we asked Commissioner Morita about it.
I live here in Cook County in Chicago, where not only did we not ban lead pipes while other states were doing it, we actually continued to require the use of lead pipes in the Chicagoland area up until the federal ban in the 1980s. And so these lead pipes contaminate our water, right, and have long-term health risks, especially to children and pregnant women. So we have to be really careful and conscious about where our water is coming from. And we're really excited at this moment right now with the federal infrastructure bill to really look at how do we move forward to fix this problem long-term.
And the commissioner shared with us her enthusiasm about the ways that the new infrastructure bill has made these repairs possible with a significant investment of federal dollars.
It's going to be a big undertaking, both financially, but also the day-to-day kind of inconvenience that a lot of us will see over the next 10 years. To the average person, it's such an inconvenience to people who don't think about water, who take that turning on the faucet for granted. But this is a real investment in the future of this country that people like me are really excited about.
Now, the infrastructure bill signed by President Biden allocates significant resources to ensure water security for all Americans. According to the White House, something like 10 million households and 400,000 schools and childcare centers don't have access to clean and safe drinking water. So to put a monetary amount on that investment in the bill, the legislation sets aside $15 billion for replacing lead pipes nationwide. It also includes $10 billion for getting chemicals known as PFAS out of drinking water, something you've covered right here on The Takeaway, Melissa, in terms of these PFAS known as forever chemicals. Now, on top of that, there's $30 billion earmarked for overhauling wastewater management systems and sewage systems, many of which need adjustments in order to continue functioning as storms get more severe due to climate change.
So the infrastructure bill, I mean, it's a critically important piece of legislation. It's going to have real effects for water safety, access, and availability for the residents of Chicago and for thousands of communities across the country. But it still doesn't address all the thorny issues. I mean, we've been talking about water access and availability as though it's like a single issue for all households in any given community. But research shows that Black and Latinx households are nearly twice as likely to lack complete plumbing as compared to white households. And when a community has a high concentration of people of color, then it also has a much higher percentage of homes that lack adequate plumbing.
And we also know that many poor and working class households simply have their water turned off. So let's dive a little deeper.
I think we've seen the dangers of shutting off people's water due to inability to pay. The studies show that a national moratorium on water shutoffs could have saved over 9,000 lives in terms of COVID deaths and over 500,000 COVID cases. So when people have their water shut off, they're moving in with other family members. They are sometimes trying to connect to other people's water in unsanitary ways. They're having to make dangerous choices. People oftentimes in Chicago, they have these $1,000 water bills and they move just because of their water bill. So they're moving from place to place. Their children are changing schools. People are living out of their cars. I mean, these are the kind of stories that we hear from people who are having their water bill shut off because they can't pay. And a water bill that maybe started as $50 with all of the additional fees and all the things that happen end up being $13,000 water bills.
Like inadequate plumbing and unsafe drinking water, water shutoffs are connected to racial inequality.
We know that it's largely low-income communities of color that are being impacted by these water shutoffs, that it's low-income communities, actually not so much in the city of Chicago, but in the south suburban areas here in Illinois that have had massive water contamination issues. We actually just got off of a water shutoff, you know, no drinking water notice in Dixmoor, which is a small, largely African-American suburb here in Cook County area. And so we've seen that the majority of water quality, water access, water affordability issues are happening in communities of color, to Native American communities across the country. And so it is, there's nothing more fundamental than that, the access to clean drinking water. If you don't have that, you really don't have much else. And so making sure that communities of color are at the forefront of these conversations as those that have been most impacted by the lack of access, lack of affordability, lack of quality drinking water, being dismissed and ignored when they have concerns and issues about the quality of their drinking water and the impact it has on their children. These are the conversations that we need to have about why water is not, you know, just this kind of over there environmental white people issue. It is at home in communities of color every day.
And as we're discussing Chicago, it's probably tempting to think of water problems as issues in cities.
but we talked with someone who helped us understand that rural areas are particularly hard hit.
Tom Miller, I am a research assistant professor of geography and environmental sustainability at the University of Oklahoma.
Now, Professor Miller reminded us that our personal homes, that's actually not where we use the most water.
So maybe that you might think of us using at the household level. That is not by far the largest use of water, particularly in the United States, right? The largest use of water in the United States is thermoelectric power. And then also we use a lot for agriculture and for irrigation.
And he helped us understand why we should not overlook water issues in rural areas.
Lots of rural areas are seeing persistent out-migration, which is impacting a tax base, which is basically makes it really hard for community water systems to update what's going on. When it comes to reservations, you also have the issue where tribal nations don't have access to the same kind of federal resources as non-reservation rural areas. So it becomes even harder, and there's an entirely vexing kind of bureaucratic patchwork that makes it really difficult to get anything fixed, particularly in the reservation context.
And now we're turning to a very different part of the country, Navajo Nation.
Navajo Nation is the country's largest reservation at just over 27,000 square miles and about 190,000 residents. Navajo Nation touches three states, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. And for Navajo Nation, water is a multifaceted challenge. Way back in August, we talked right here on The Takeaway about one layer of this issue, the water shortage in the Colorado River.
The Colorado River supplies water for 40 million people, irrigates 6 million acres of land, and generates more than 4,000 megawatts of hydropower from its dams. Also, the Colorado River is drying up. The Colorado feeds Lake Mead, the nation's largest man-made reservoir. And Lake Mead is now only 35% full. That's the lowest level since it was created nearly 100 years ago.
Now, my guest that day was Bita Becker, an attorney with the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, who explained the disproportionate impact on Indian country.
The hydropower is the cheapest power we can buy. So when hydropower gets threatened and then we have to go out and purchase higher cost power, we're just further impacting the challenges that our people are facing.
Then she told us,
grab a map and look at the border between Arizona and California. There are five tribes along that stretch of the river who have long lived there. And one of them is named the Kokopah tribe. The center of their universe is their river. The center of everything they believe in is the river. So when the river dries up or goes away, you're taking out kind of the center of their being.
Melissa, when Attorney Becker told us to grab a map, she was giving us a map for thinking about the specific experiences of water in Navajo Nation. So to lean in more, we sat down with Jonathan Nez, president of the Navajo Nation.
30 to 40% of our Navajo citizens don't have running water. Believe it or not, I, as the president of the largest tribe in the country, the Navajo Nation, my family don't have access to running water. We haul water. It takes us 30 miles, 60 miles round trip to get water, getting 250 gallon or more containers in back of your truck, taking it to a water well, waiting in line because there's a lot of people usually. You take it back home and cattle and horses and sheep and goats, you know, that's where we would first get water to our animals. And then for farming too, you know, growing season, getting water to those plants. And then afterwards, you take the rest of the water back to the house for drinking, cooking, and cleaning. And once the water is all gone, you got to do another trip to get another load of water for the next couple of days or so.
And President Nez linked this individual household level experience of water insecurity to the broader environmental and political questions of water availability and access.
Because of the drought and because of what's happening in the Southwest in terms of the need for water, we can see that it'll be a contentious issue because the Navajo Nation is in discussions of our water rights. In Arizona, we have to continue to educate state leaders about the need for a permanent homeland for our Navajo citizens. So we just want our fair share for to continue to establish our permanent homeland for our Navajo people.
My name is Bita Becker. I'm an attorney with the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, and I'm also on the leadership team for the Water and Tribes Initiative in the Colorado River Basin.
Attorney Becker returned to The Takeaway to talk with us for this deep dive.
For many communities, their source of clean drinking water is their local government, right? It's like it's the person living down the street. For a Native American community, it's the members of Congress, right? So in 1959, Congress created a program called the Indian Health Service Sanitation Facilities Construction Program, specifically to address clean drinking water to homes. In the 50s, the term used is sanitation. Now we use the term clean or safe drinking water.
Okay, so this is a reference to Public Law 86-121. It was signed by President Eisenhower back in 1959, and it authorizes the Surgeon General to construct essential sanitation facilities for American Indian and Alaska Native homes and communities.
Wait, the Surgeon General?
Yep, exactly. Because rather than defining water primarily as physical infrastructure, this act recognizes that the provision of adequate sanitation and water, Melissa, it's truly a public health issue. And since 1959, federal resources have reached more than 250,000 homes and helped to improve health in Indian country. But Attorney Becker helped us understand that the progress has been halting and inadequate.
The Indian Health Service would report every year what is called the sanitation deficiency list. So this is a known list that the federal government creates of known sanitation deficiencies. So the federal government knows these problems exist. The IHS requests funding. They were only getting a few million dollars a year. So they would report that given the level of funding they have and the backlog, once they received funding, it would take about 6 years to get the project built. So you're looking at 10 years before somebody gets their clean drinking water system built at their home. And I think fundamentally that's the story that's very hard to tell, is how many people have we lost? And I don't mean just passed away, but I mean who've been forced to move away from their traditional homelands, the lands, you know, that our grandmas and grandpas fought for us. How many of these people had to leave because they, you know, because it's very hard to hold a 9-to-5 job when you can't take a shower in the morning and make your coffee and use a flushable toilet.
In 2019, researchers from the U.S. Water Alliance released a report titled Closing the Water Access Gap. They found that Native Americans face more water access issues than any other group. The report indicates that many living in Navajo Nation have fewer than 10 gallons of water at home at any given time. And just to understand what that means, Melissa, the average American uses 88 gallons of water every single day. And as Attorney Becker told us, this is not a new problem. Inadequate water access has plagued Indian country for decades. But in a somewhat surprising turn, the COVID-19 pandemic brought these inequities to light for many in the broader American public.
You know, again, this issue has been going on for a long time, right? But it really hit home what it means to lack access to clean drinking water. And the pandemic really shined a light on what sanitation means.
And with this new attention came new resources for solutions. Here again is Jonathan Nez, president of Navajo Nation.
There's a lot of lessons learned throughout this pandemic, and we see that improving through some of the bills that are being introduced and that are being approved. And we appreciate the administration and our congressional delegation for hearing us.
Pausing for a moment, we'll be right back here on The Takeaway.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Have you ever had an encounter with someone that left you feeling a little braver?
I remember getting in a car and just driving, and it was just for curiosity's sake. That freedom led to, like, a lot of rediscoveries. Just for life, things became colorful again.
Join me, Helga Davis, for conversations with artists and thinkers who share my passion for living fearlessly. It's a new season of Helga. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We're back and continuing our deep dive conversation about water. And we turn now to the state of Michigan. So let's start in Flint. Dorian, I am sure you remember back in 2014 when an unelected so-called emergency manager was appointed by Michigan's governor and tasked with reducing Flint's municipal deficit. And in order to cut costs, this manager switched the city's water supply from Lake Huron to the Flint River. But the river water was corrosive, and it caused the city's pipes to leach lead into the drinking water of homes, schools, and businesses in this predominantly Black working-class city.
It was probably our nation's biggest public health disaster of the last 50 years, until the onset of the COVID pandemic.
For those who may have stopped following the water news out of Flint, Michigan, there are some updates. In January of last year, the former governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder, and seven other public officials were charged with 42 criminal counts resulting from their involvement with the crisis. Last week, the Michigan Supreme Court said those indictments are invalid. On the civil side last year, a federal judge approved a $626 million settlement for residents who were victims of the mass poisoning of the city.
It's tough to hold public officials accountable for the many harms they do to communities, Melissa, and especially economically marginal communities of color. But Flint is not the only community in Michigan facing a serious and ongoing case of water injustice.
My name is Reverend Rosalind Bouillet. I am the executive director of the Brightmoor Connection Food Pantry.
We spoke with Reverend Bouillet about the disastrous effects of widespread water shutoffs, which began in Detroit in 2014. These shutoffs were part of a debt collection policy where the city shut off water to anyone who fell behind by $150. According to reporting from The Guardian, this policy meant that by the start of the pandemic in early 2020, at least 2,800 occupied homes were without running water.
If you are unable to pay your water bill, your water is shut off. You are disconnected from having access to clean, affordable drinking water. Families have been forced to exist without having water. So when your water is shut off, you are unable to flush a toilet. You're unable to get rid of waste in the home. You are unable to clean, cook, experience any of those things that we consider to be everyday norms.
The problem was especially acute in the community of Brightmoor. And being without water is much more than just an inconvenience for individual households. It's created yet another public health crisis.
The other pandemic that has ravaged throughout Brightmoor and the city of Detroit has been hepatitis A. Hepatitis A is due to the lack of sanitary conditions. When the pandemic hit and the moratorium was not fully executed, meaning everybody's water was not restored, much less water was not being stopped from being shut off, folks had to throw their waste out in the garbage. Prior to COVID-19, the city of Detroit mandated that the sanitation workers here be required to take a hepatitis A shot because they were fully aware of the danger that was going on with not having water running in homes and waste being thrown out into the streets.
And then Reverend Bouye explained why it is essentially impossible for people who are struggling economically to have their water restored once it's been turned off.
First of all, you have to pay $150 just to have water turned on in your home. That's a deposit fee. Then you have bills, water bills. But the water bills became so unaffordable because the city attached on a sewage bill, a drainage bill, right? And what that looks like is the water that runs off your roof, runs down your gutters, into the ground, people are charged for that, right? That's the drainage fees, right? And so then when your water shut off, you have a disconnection fee. So to get your water turned back on, if that is even possible, you have to pay the deposit, everything that's in the arrearage, and the disconnection fee. So it becomes impossible to be connected back to the water system.
Now, being without water, especially during a pandemic, that is horrifying. But I have to tell you, I could barely fathom the idea that a municipal policy of shutting off water for an unpaid $150 could actually threaten a mother's custody of her child.
And in Brightmoor, what was happening is that whereas it would normally take a little while, it take, you know, at least 30 to 60 days before the children were removed from the homes, in Brightmoor, they began to come out and take the children the very same day that the water was shut off. And to move this conversation into the forefront of centering Blackness, because as I said, over the largest population that has been shut off for water has been Black women with small children. And we know that when children are removed from the home and placed in foster care system, there's a high propensity that these foster care children will end up in the penal system.
Oh, Melissa, I just have to say, I was struck that Reverend Bouye did not see these practices as simply sad or tragic. She described them as intentional and strategic.
It was always intended to move folks off the land, to move the families out of these communities, because everyone, I'm sure, hears about Detroit's comeback. That's 7.2 square miles of downtown Detroit. Detroit encompasses 144 square miles, but of those 137 square miles, we have the outer areas of families who are trying to live and exist, the largest population of which oftentimes is Black women with small children in these dense populated communities such as Brightmoor.
To further emphasize this point, she told us that the only laundromat in the community had to be closed to make room for a new grocery co-op. Now, while Brightmoor residents do live with food insecurity, she clearly understood this policy choice to be an indication of purposeful gentrification.
In a community with the highest population of water shutoffs, with the only access to one laundromat, tells you that for the laundromat to be closed down and be converted into a food co-op, that says this is for the people who are coming, not for the ones who are here. It also tells you that green plants that grow in Black dirt can get water while Black children cannot.
When we decided to take a deep dive into water, I had no idea it was going to lead us to so many places.
So many places, Melissa. We've heard about how water insecurity affects infant and adult health in poor nations across the globe, and we've listened to the heart-wrenching realities of water inequality right here at home, in Chicago, in Detroit, and in Navajo Nation.
And of course, we've seen that water is not just about lived experience. It is a political battleground. Professor Sarah Young offered us a kind of great quote for thinking about it.
Well, you know, Mark Twain said that whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. And that may or may not be misattributed to him, but it's a good line either way, in the sense that governments do recognize that water is an important resource for economic productivity and health and political stability.
Well, let's be honest. Whiskey has caused a few fights too, but the point is well taken. Determining who has access to water, how they get that access, and how much they must pay for it are all questions about power.
And of course, questions about power are always matters of politics. And of course, Norman, we've all been watching politics at work as D.C. lawmakers passed and signed into law this historic infrastructure bill. The resources made available by this new law are potentially game-changing for many communities, particularly among Native Americans. So here's Bita Becker of the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority.
I believe it's a sea change. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, for the first time in my life, well, not the first time in the history of the country, we're seeing full funding, but it's something that I never thought we would have seen. It took a pandemic, but I would argue that that the people of this country are responding. I hate to use the term right, but I think it is the right way. We have years of work ahead of us. The hard work is ahead. Because it's going to take a lot of work to deploy this funding. But I remain hopeful.
It took a pandemic. But we've had several crises around water insecurity over the years and decades where, frankly, water injustices were made crystal clear to all of us, whether Flint or Indian country, and we collectively failed to act. But Melissa, water experts continue to create and innovate strategies for just water use and water security. Commissioner Morita shared with us some of the innovative new ways that local decision makers are thinking about water.
There are some really cool things that are happening around water, both on the drinking water side as well as the wastewater side. You know, drinking water is a finite resource. And the way that this country has thought about drinking water is, you know, the opposite of the ways that other countries. So Illinois, where I live, is one of a handful of states that not only doesn't allow for water recycling, but requires that we use potable water for everything. So we use potable water to flush our toilets. We use potable water for manufacturing. Other countries like Hong Kong, it's illegal to flush your toilet with drinking water. So we're wasting millions and millions of not billions of gallons of drinking water, as well as the cost that it takes to get water to drinkable status. So I sit on the National Blue Ribbon Commission for Non-Potable Water Systems. And I think that in the future, we are going to see that we don't just talk about water as one category, but that there are different levels of water that have different levels of uses. And that we are wasting incredible amounts of money, incredible amounts of energy, and incredible amounts of actual potable drinking water because of this, what we call water mismatch. So flushing your toilet with drinking water is a water mismatch. You know, watering golf courses with drinking water instead of storm water. Doing manufacturing with drinking water instead of treated effluent. These are all things that I think we are going to start to think about and understand water in really different ways instead of this just one category of good water is drinking water, everything else is bad water.
Justice cannot exclude the most vulnerable. In fact, it must center them and it must challenge and alter the narratives that deepen inequality. Because as Reverend Bouye told us, there is no going back to so-called normal before the pandemic.
The narrative that's been running rampant is that with the water affordability, then you'll be paying for someone's water who doesn't want to pay their bill. They're going out and wasting their money and you'll be paying their water bill. That's not true. It's that people cannot afford water, right? Water affordability plans benefit everyone. I'd like for people to walk away with the fact that this pandemic is still raging. And while we've gone back to what we consider to be our normal, what is normal for one person is not a blessing to return to for others. So when we say, well, we're glad that things are going back to normal, normal doesn't look the same for everyone. Normal was overrated to begin with.
So Dorian, I know that after this deep dive, I'm never going to think about water in quite the same way again. I mean, I'm certainly never going to take it for granted or assume that it simply flows clean, safe, and reliable from the tap for everybody. And I will definitely not only be paying my bill, but I'm also going to be paying much more attention to all the ways that water is used to disempower and marginalize and harm rather than being used to sustain and support. So I just want to say thank you to you again, my friend, for taking time out of your schedule to go on this water journey with me and with the community of The Takeaway.
Well, thank you, Melissa, because speaking of water, I feel like we just scratched the surface of the, you know, proverbial iceberg when it comes to water security and water justice. So thanks for this deep dive on water.
And as we sign off, I want to say thank you to all of our guests today, Bita Becker, Josina Marita, Reverend Rosalind Bouye, Jonathan Nez, Sarah Young, and Tom Miller. And we want to leave you with their voices, affirming the core underlying truth they did seem to all agree about when it came to water.
So human beings are biological entities. We are made up of water. 60% of our body is water. We live on a blue planet. Our planet is made up of water. Every single human being needs water to survive.
Water is a human right. We all deserve fresh, affordable drinking water.
Access to clean drinking water is a human right.
Water is life.
One of the sustainable development goals, right, for the whole world is to have everybody having access to clean water and sanitation.
And that's going to help policymakers to prioritize water to be the unique and irreplaceable resource that it is.
All right. Thank you to all of our guests today for talking water with us. And thanks for being part of our Deep Dive Week here on The Takeaway. And hey, go check out all of our deep dives at thetakeaway.org. Just click on the Deep Dive tab and find the whole series there. Also, hit subscribe on The Takeaway wherever you get podcasts. Big thanks to our Takeaway crew for this week and every week. Our broadcast engineer is Vince Fairchild. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Jackie Martin is our line producer. Shanta Covington and Ethan Oberman are our senior producers. Katarina Barton, Deborah Goldstein, Ryan Wild, and Mary Steffenhagen are our producers. Callie Teitelbaum is our intern. Zach Bynum is our digital producer, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Juan Bo Wu is our executive producer. For our crew, rolling deep as always, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. See you Monday.